show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
Live from the Music Box Theater here in Chicago, this is Film Spotting 500, sponsored by WBEZ. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. I don't know what I told you, but if you have work for me to do, I can do it.
You seem so familiar to me.
What do you do?
I do many, many things. I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man. Hopelessly inquisitive man, just like you.
Is this how you got all your co-hosts to join the cult of film spotting, Adam?
I like to think of it more as a movement, really.
Well, for our 500th episode, the master here and I will name our top five films of the film spotting era. That's 2005 to 2014.
Helping us out, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, Slate's Dana Stevens, and via video, the newly anointed writer-director of Star Wars Episode VIII. He is Rian Johnson.
Always two.
Go for it, Mary Poppins.
Always two there are, no more, no less, a master and an apprentice.
Wow.
That was Yoda.
Just don't bust that out at all, ever again, the rest of the show. That and lots more ahead on this special live edition of Film Spotting. Quick sponsor read here, everybody. This live episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Harry's. For all you guys here at the Music Box or listening via podcast who want a great shave for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com and get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code FILMSPOTTING when you check out. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. We are live this week from the stage of the beautiful Music Box Theater here on Chicago's North Side. We're celebrating the recording of our 500th episode. Welcome, everybody, to Film Spotting number 500. It's 10 o'clock. It's after 10. We've got a ton of ground to cover. We are determined, as I said, to get you home before sunup. So we're going to dive right into the top five. We're commemorating this 500th episode by considering the films from what we're calling, pretentiously, the film spotting era.
I think that's commonly used.
Everyone
I've heard it
that,
a lot.
Right. By the end of the night, we'll have named our top five films from the last 9 years, 4 months, and 20 days. I believe that was a Romanian film. Great work. Slate's Dana Stevens and our beloved Michael Phillips from the Tribune will join us later in the show to share their picks. Rian Johnson, to old friends, of course, everyone here, the director of one of the great film debuts of all time, 2005's Brick. To everyone else, the recently named director of Star Wars Episode VIII. He's going to join us appropriately on the big screen via Skype a little later as well. But we did want to start the show, as we did way back in 2005, just two guys, a couple of mics, talking about movies.
Did you do that here at the Music Box?
A little bit humbler beginnings for that first podcast with Sam. There are more people in this room right now than heard our first 10 shows combined, I think, which is pretty remarkable. But yeah, I think we're ready, Josh. Let's go ahead and jump right in. Top five films of the film spotting era. I am dying to know if you saved a classic Larson pick for this top five. Maybe that number five slot, even a Steve Conrad movie. The City of Cedar Rapids maybe making an appearance. Michael Bay. Actually, you know what? I got it. Fish Heads.
Ooh. Fish Heads. If only we were doing video, we could watch that mesmerizing scene again.
Everybody would love that.
Oh, now we're just disappointing everyone. No Fish Heads, no Leviathan on this list. If we talk top 10 at some point, perhaps we'd hear about Cedar Rapids, but we'll get to that down the road. My number five, and first off, I do need to say that I discovered making this list top 10 lists, annual ones, which I've been doing since 05, star ratings, which I do on my site, completely meaningless the next day. And that has become more true when I thought I would just look at my list and, okay, I've got my five, no problem. But your responses to films change, the world around them changes, and so your lists change. So here's where I am at right now. Number five film of the film spotting era is Meek's Cutoff. This is Kelly Reichardt's Oregon Trail period piece with Michelle Williams as a bonnet among beards. And despite that description, it's not entirely correct to call this a feminist Western, I don't think. It's more of a post-feminist one, and that's because Reichardt, she has such an egalitarian way of telling this particular story. She makes space for everyone involved, so that includes the men, includes the women, includes the lone Native American that this band of travelers comes across. And formally, just in terms of the filmmaking, Meek's Cutoff is in. It's there's just endlessly interesting things to study there. The exquisite lighting alone, a lot of it which comes from period-appropriate sources, the use of lanterns here is just magical. She has this patient, inquisitive camera too that is right there for the moments you need to tell the story. I think of the shot of the caged canary being carried over this really dangerous river. And the sound design, the minimalist sound design. You hear the squeak of wagon wheels, whispered conversations in tents. Great stuff. So this is a period Western that's, I think it's as immersed in its time and place as anything maybe since Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which, you know, interestingly is also an egalitarian Western, I'd say. So Meek's Cutoff is my number four.
Wow, that's maybe a little bit higher than I expected it, but
my number it's
your number five. It's a fabulous film, obviously one we've championed a lot here on Film Spotting over the years. And speaking of championing films, that was something I was really considering for this top five. Do I go with movies that maybe I had an affection for more than many other people or even many other critics? It's always good to have a unique list, try not to go with obvious choices. But in the end, I decided that these films had to truly stand on their own as great achievements. Filmmakers at the tops of their games. Cinematic elements, story, thematic resonance, everything I want at the movies on display in these picks. And as I was going through it, I don't know about you, Josh, but I realized that I wasn't considering my 5, 10, 15, whatever, favorite movie since 2005 so much as my favorite scenes. I was thinking about my favorite moments that have been captured on screen over the past 9 years plus, that these scenes that really left an indelible mark on me, that filled me with, frankly, a sense of awe watching a movie. And they also prompted great conversations with hosts, between listeners, between critics and audiences. And so those conversations along with those scenes are what really keep me coming back to those movies. So with that, my number five is a little bit of a pick just for you, Josh, because you don't know this one's coming.
No.
And I'm sure you're really going to appreciate it. It's Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. And see, I got the crowd behind me already.
I would estimate about 15% of the crowd behind you already.
Well played. But you talk about scenes, as I was saying, the scenes that really left their mark. The precision and tension of that opening scene, our introduction to Hans Landa. The pub scene, of course, with my guy, the actor of the Film Spotting era, right? Michael Fassbender. There you go. I'm getting a moron on my side, Josh. That sequence, like so many in that film, that highlight one of Tarantino's favorite preoccupations, the power of performance and the consequences of a failed performance. And then, of course, the thrilling and the disturbing, and disturbing because it's thrilling, finale of Inglourious Basterds. And Josh, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but there were some critics who really didn't like this movie too much. And they couldn't write about it without calling Tarantino a little immature, maybe referring to him as a mere provocateur, or worse, just saying he was blatantly hypocritical for offering us a film full of arguably gratuitous violence, then calling us out for reveling in that violence. You know what I'm going to call Tarantino, Josh? I'm just going to call him an artist. An artist doing in Bastards what great artists do. He's challenging us with his contradictions and his provocations, as impeccably crafted as those provocations are. Inglourious Basterds, my number five.
Yeah, we agree on Django Unchained. We agree on Pulp Fiction. This one, we're going to have to set aside some time at some point to talk about why we don't agree on it, because I do think it is one of his most divisive films, so that those who do appreciate his other stuff have a problem there, and we don't have time tonight. My number four is Volver. This is Pedro... Yes, thank you. Pedro Almodovar's 2006 murder thriller slash family reunion film starring Penelope Cruz. And here's the puzzle of Almodovar. Why does a movie that features murder, abuse, awful family secrets that come to light, why does it also have this much warmth? I think you can ask that question about a lot of his films, differing subject matters, but the warmth always comes out. I can only answer it here as it does apply to Volver. And I think it's that he and his movie, they're less interested in the voyeuristic appeal of the terrible elements of this story. They're more interested in depicting the resilience of the characters who are going through this and the aftermath of their awful experiences. That's where this movie settles. And what characters there are here and what actresses to play them. You have Cruz and Lola Duenas as sisters, Carmen Mora as their deceased mother, who makes this ghostly reappearance about halfway through that is just wonderful. They're all good, but Cruise, and this is like Bette Davis, Joan Crawford stuff. This is glamour and grit in one performance, and it's just really wonderful to watch. So Volver is probably my favorite Almodovar film, and it's my fourth best film of the film Spotting Era.
Now, I know that you had just recently rewatched this in prepping for this show. I mean, were you surprised at all by just how much you loved it, or did you think it was a lock?
The ones I rewatched were the ones I wasn't sure about, but that's not quite true. This one, I didn't know where it would fall. And the fact that it did kind of grow in richness, it was like, it's got to be on there. So,
well, I do want to thank you, Josh, for picking with your number five film, a female-driven film from a great female director in Reichert. And with your number four, a great female-driven film by a great male director who, you know, Almodovar, he probably tells the best female story, certainly, of any male director out there, always has throughout his career, and it really will highlight just how brorific my list is. So, great. Thank you. Appreciate that, Josh. My number four, speaking of brorific films with, I don't think there's a female character in the movie, and yet, sorry, it's my number four pick. It is Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood. I looked back at my review notes, and I referenced in the discussion at the time a Dennis Lim article on Slate that was published when Blood came out. I think it was looking back over Anderson's career, and it's funny because Lim wrote this. He listed a bunch of directors. He said, Steven Soderbergh, David Fincher, Quentin Tarantino, Richard Linklater, Todd Haynes, Sofia Coppola, Alexander Payne. Many of them have a specialty. Fincher is a visual virtuoso, Linklater a verbal stylist. Payne is good with character. Coppola with moods and music. Tarantino has the encyclopedic geek smarts. Soderbergh, the taste for reinvention. With Paul Thomas Anderson, all of the above apply. His thing is he can do it all. And I think that really nails it about what makes Paul Thomas Anderson so great. Obviously, in light of what we're going to get to in a moment, too, our death match between Linklater and Soderbergh may be worth revisiting that quote. But when I think about Paul Thomas Anderson and I think about There Will Be Blood in particular, the dialogue, the compositions, the movement of the camera, the editing, the music, obviously that great, haunting Johnny Greenwood score, the performances he gets almost across the board in that film. I think that's one we disagree on, Paul Dano and his performance in that movie. But he wields every element of cinema with sophistication and intensity. And I think what really has always struck me about PTA is the richness and the bigness of his topics. He makes really intimate stories at its core. Almost all of his films are often about fathers and sons or father and sons type characters. And those relationships, they are very private, or there's a small group that we see together, an ensemble in Boogie Nights. But these stories have the sweep and the scale of the ever unfolding tale, really, that is America. He sums it all up in his films. So Paul Thomas Anderson and There Will Be Blood, number four pick.
Brorific. I like that. But I think for his films, and he does make space for women characters frequently, but even something like There Will Be Blood, they're brorific to a purpose. I mean, they're telling these tales focused. It's not at the exclusion of female characters who are there and should be given more time,
right?
If that makes any sense.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
these are the exact stories he means to tell, and he goes full bore into them. So,
and obviously, in terms of unforgettable moments, we could all sit here and probably recount them from that film. The milkshake scene at the end, that became iconic and so memorable and so quoted and parodied, but it probably doesn't even make my top five There Will Be Blood scenes. The Abandon My Child sequence in church certainly would. There's so many complex emotions and psychological nastiness in that sequence going on there that I don't know really where to even begin with it. And that set piece of the fire in the oil fields when the well burns up is obviously very striking, but it all comes back to, as well, the first 20 minutes of that film, mostly silent, just watching Daniel Plainview work and discover that first bit of oil that makes him rich. It's with that music, it's just remarkable stuff. So we have gotten through two picks here, Josh, fairly swiftly, but we do have other business to get to as we get to our poll questions.
You know how I said I shot five men? It weren't true. That Mexican had come at me with a knife. I just busted his leg with a shovel. I didn't kill him enough to need it.
Well, you sure killed the hell out of that fella today.
Hell yeah. I killed the hell out of him, didn't I? Three shots and he was taking a shit.
Take a drink, kid.
It don't seem real. I ain't gonna never breathe again, ever. How he's dead. And the other one, too. All on account of pulling a trigger.
It's a hell of a thing, killing a man. take away all he's got and all he's ever gonna have.
Clint Eastwood, William Money, and James Wolvett as the Schofield kid in Eastwood's Unforgiven. We've had a pair of poll questions. Many of you have gone there and voted. We thank you for that at filmspotting.net. Been running on the site the past couple of weeks. And we're also going to get the audience response here to these death matches. We've been looking ahead to our next Sacred Cow discussion. Don't know when it's going to happen, but focusing on the top five films of 1992. And we picked out two films from 1992 that were standout pictures. Obviously, the best picture winner there. You just heard the clip from Unforgiven from Eastwood. But Reservoir Dogs, as we talk about Tarantino, that movie, his debut, came out that year as well. So those are the two we settled on. We're going to let, basically, the listeners decide it. We're going to hear the results as they came out at filmspotting.net. But
is it
first,
still too late for me to vote? I think I forgot to vote.
You forgot? Well, I don't think it's going to matter. I think it's pretty well decided, but the crowd here may shift it. I'm counting on you guys. Your votes count for about 300, so 400. So here we go. By round of applause, we're going to give you the two choices. Applaud for the one you think is most worthy of a Sacred Cow discussion on Film Spotting. The first one is Unforgiven. Reservoir Dogs. Wow.
You guys just really messed things up.
You did. Josh has been looking forward to this Unforgiven talk, Sam, our producer, as well. But let's go to the poll results. How did it come out?
Well, with over 1,700 votes submitted, would have been a one with mine, Reservoir Dogs gets 48% of the vote, Unforgiven gets 52% of the vote.
Man,
so
yeah,
now what do we do? You got to add 300 to that.
I know.
I'm out when it comes to this math.
We're gonna give it another week, maybe. We're too indecisive, but thank you. The Reservoir Dogs, I think, that's going to be hard for everyone here to actually overlook just how enthusiastic you guys were. Next up in our poll questions, we've been running a classic Film Spotting deathmatch poll between two of our favorite directors, Soderbergh and Linklater. This one, Josh, not so close, actually. And we're going to want to hear it from the crowd this time as well. You can only choose one. The other director's filmography, it gets fed into the fire. It's gone forever. And yes, for those of you who have seen it, that includes Richard Linklater's Boyhood. So you can only pick one filmography. Let's throw it out to you guys. We'll start with Steven Soderbergh. Round of applause. Okay, not bad. Richard Linklater. That sounds about right.
Yeah. Nice job. That was a little bit better. Soderbergh, 41% of the vote. Linklater, 59%.
Well, the feedback, let's get to a couple responses here, Josh, was more evenly divided. Daniel Hardy, this is possibly one of the toughest director death matches I can think of. Two intellectual, extremely prolific directors who love experimentation and have worked across a range of budgets in both indie and studio fare. I think the timing of the poll coming right as Boyhood comes out and after the much-loved conclusion to the Before trilogy last year gives the edge to Linklater. But Soderbergh's great filmography is perhaps ultimately a richer one, to wit. Top 10 only. Out of Sight, A+. Traffic, A. Che, A. Sex, Lies, and Videotape, A-. Ocean's 11, A-. Solaris, A-. Aaron Brockovich, A-. The Limey, A-. Contagion, B+. Magic Mike, B+. Now we go to Linklater. Boyhood, A+. Before Sunset, A+. Dazed and Confused, A+. Before Midnight, A. Before Sunrise, A. Slacker, B+. School of Rock, B+. A Scanner Darkly, B+. Waking Life, B+. And even Bernie, B+. Damn it, I think Linklater wins. No, wait, Soderbergh. He can't decide either. So, you know, that's how hard this death match was.
Max O'Connell, regular emailer, wrote from Syracuse, New York, Soderbergh has arguably made more great movies than Linklater, but my favorite Linklater films, the Before trilogy and Dazed and Confused, are closer to my heart, and I couldn't bear to lose them. Sorry, Out of Sight, and endless repeats of Ocean's 11 on TV. You were a blast while you lasted.
They're gone. Soderbergh's filmography, I guess, just wiped out there. Well, we have a special treat here. We're going to hear from the champ. One of our great producers, Golden Joe Dassault, had a chance to sit down with Richard Linklater recently on a visit to WBEZ. We did not get him to weigh in on this poll question. Thought that might be a little wrong. But we did get him to weigh in on this top five for tonight. His number one pick, favorite film of the Film Spotting era.
I've been roped into talking about what film of the last 5 or is it 10 years that I would what rate highest, or I have to think in more of an activist way of a film that you should go see. Maybe I won't put some obvious ones I feel everyone's seen, but maybe something I thought was really special that if you haven't seen, you should see, you should think about. And that would be, because I saw it just recently again, and I'm a fan of Charlie Kaufman's Synecdoche, New York. I think that's just kind of an amazing achievement on a meta level about life and art and cinema. And, you know, if you haven't seen it, go see it. It's quite an achievement.
Our thanks to Richard Linklater. Obviously not a religious film spotting listener. He must somehow have forgotten that scintillating interview I did with him about Fast Food Nation many years ago. But certainly a great pick, one that's not going to get any argument from me on Synecdoche, New York.
Well, I still feel bad about that Yoda impression.
As you should.
So I'm going to try and redeem myself next with Massacre Theater. Then we'll have our video interview with Jedi in Training, Rian Johnson. You know how I heard he got the Star Wars gig, Adam?
Tell me.
Impeccable Yoda impression. Stay with us.
The sun is sinking in the west. The cattle go down to the stream. The red wing settles in her nest. It's time for a cowboy to dream. Purple eyes in the canyon. That's where I long to be with my three good companions. Just my rifle, pony, and me. Gonna hang my sombrero on the limb of a tree. Coming home, sweetheart, darling, just my rifle, pony, and me.
Whippoorwill in the willow.
Hey, everybody, we hope you're enjoying this special 500th episode of Film Spotting. Want to jump in for a second just to remind you that this episode is brought to you by Harry's. And Josh, we've had Harry's on as a sponsor before. I think it was a few months ago, and it was unfortunate because I was gone that week.
You were.
Had to do.
I had to talk about your shaving habits.
You had to do the Harry's bit, and you're a guy who barely shaves.
Haven't done a clean shave in years.
Wow. You do always sport that Don Johnson-esque 5 o'clock shadow, and it works for you. I can't do it. I'm a guy who has to shave every day. And it sounds like maybe one of our listeners, Ethan McElhenney in Pittsburgh, PA, is one of those guys as well, or maybe at least more like me. He wrote us in, Josh, after we did our last testimonial for Harry's and said, thank you for the offer code from Harry's. I got my Truman set today and must say that after years with an electric shaver, the transition to a Harry's razor has been spectacular. So thank you, Ethan, for that.
Pretty convincing. Maybe I'll have to do that clean shave.
I'm a Winston guy myself versus
you go for the
Truman.
Winston.
Yeah, but Harry's really is fantastic. And as I said, I am someone who has to shave every single day. So finding a company like Harry's that can give me great razor blades at a cheaper price and make it easy by having them delivered to my doorstep is something I really do appreciate. The company was founded by two guys, Andy and Jeff, who figured there had to be a better way to do this. They give you that great shave experience with their razor blades that are engineered at their own factory in Germany. And as I mentioned, that convenience and ease of ordering online so you can skip the razor aisle. So the way I did it, Josh, you even sign up for the service and I don't have to do anything. I just know that every 2 months I'm going to get 8 more blades delivered to my door. So it really does make it so much more convenient. And the product design, they call it less but better. And so far, I have to agree with them in terms of that Harry's razor and blade that I use. So definitely highly recommend Harry's.com.
You want to share Adam's experience? Go to Harry's.com. That's Harry's.com. Use the offer code FilmSpotting to get $5 off your first purchase. That's Harry's.com, promo code FilmSpotting. We thank Harry's for their support of FilmSpotting.
No more cow.
No more cow.
To be roping.
To be roping.
No more stray.
No more stray.
Will I see
round the bend?
Round the bend.
She'll be waiting.
She'll be waiting
for my rifle, pony, and me.
my rifle, my pony, and me.
Hello and welcome to our debut podcast from Chicago. This is Cinecast. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. Coming up on this week's show, review the new movie Be Cool, count down our top five movies about movies, and take a look back at the Oscars.
Yeah. Paging the Museum of Broadcast Communications. That was what Film Spotting sounded like way back when it was Cinecast, before Sam added a van to his name back in March 2005.
You had a really low voice for a 9-year-old.
Seriously. I was so young and naive. Yet you guys have stuck with us. 9 years later, we're here on the stage of the Music Box Theater recording episode number 500. And maybe my favorite thing about that first episode, which truly you couldn't pay me to listen to, is the note on our website that we posted that accompanies it. It reads, "Please note that we originally envisioned a 20 to 30 minute show, not the 45 minute program we have managed to produce. While we don't expect to be so long-winded in subsequent shows, we'd love to hear any feedback you have on the show's length or any other comments for that matter."
You know, you still tell me that after every recording.
I know. But the irony of that, you know, now that our shows are routinely about 3 hours long, I don't remember anyone actually complaining about the length, mostly because nobody was really listening at the time. But we did eventually hear from you guys, the listeners, and your influence on the show since those early days really can't be stated. It can't be summed up briefly here anyway on stage. This week's top five. Adolfo, you out there? There he is, Adolfo. See, on Twitter, the first guy who chimed in when we said, this is like 2 weeks ago, we're totally unprepared for this show, and we say, what should we do for a top five for our 500th episode? Adolfo writes in on Twitter, boom, saw it, said,
nice
that's
work,
it.
Sir.
That's our top five, and here we are doing it. So from our marathons to everything we do on the show, almost all of it is driven by you guys. So thank you, everyone here tonight, and all the listeners out there for supporting us over the years. Josh, we will get back to our top five films of the Film Spotting era a bit later. We've also got Ryan Johnson beaming in from an undisclosed location somewhere on Naboo in just a bit. But it is time for yet another edition of Massacre Theater.
The 494th
that
edition of
right.
Massacre
yeah,
Theater.
Something like that. It's high.
Only about a fifth of that blood is on my hands.
That's
true. I
just
want you to know that. All right, Massacre Theater, we perform a scene. You get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, it was episode 499. We reviewed Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer, a film we both liked quite a bit. And we shared our top five magical realism moments in movies. We also massacred this scene.
Oh, it's awfully dark and gloomy up there.
Now, you see how wrong people can be? That there is what you might call a doorway to a place of enchantment. Up where the smoke is all billowed and curled.
Between pavement and stars is the chimney's sweet world. Where there's hardly no day nor hardly no night. There's things half in shadow and halfway in light.
Oh, man. We just couldn't resist merging those together. It really is Josh's attempt to get it so right that makes it so memorable when it's that wrong. Dick Van Dyke, his Cockney accent, Mary Poppins, was already pretty bad. Josh, yours was, I don't know how to describe it, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious?
But see, by being bad, I was being good because I was being true to the text.
That's true.
Right?
That's true. Mary Poppins
how this works.
From 1964, directed by Robert Stevenson, written by Bill Walsh and Don DeGrady. It was a tie-in with our top five magic realism moments. If you want to hear that episode, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen to the show at filmspotting.net. We had some listeners with a few connections they caught. Pete Craig, Alexandria, Virginia. The connection, everyday magic featured throughout, a flying umbrella, a bottomless travel bag. There's definitely something about Mary. I liked Josh's accent choice. Rather than trying to go Cockney, he instead went for Dick Van Dyke trying to go Cockney, which was much more distinctive.
Pete gets it.
I also think Sam layered under a few bars of Chim Chimmery to set the scene, which was a very nice touch. This is my favorite part here. And Adam's standard, vaguely feminine and earnest, but otherwise wholly unremarkable line reading rounded out the whole thing. And what I love about that so much is take out arguably the vaguely feminine part, and earnest but otherwise wholly unremarkable pretty much sums up my tenure here on Film Spotting. That's what I'm bringing to the show week after week, Josh.
Yes, make him feel
just
better,
for
please.
Sympathy.
Matt Bird from London said, I have to say that as an Englishman, I thought Dick Van Dyke's Cockney accent was the worst possible. Not so. Yours veered from Jamaican to Scottish and was all the more enjoyable for it. It did get a little wobbly at the end.
Jamaican mixed with Scottish is every accent you do, Josh. I don't know if it's by design or not, but a lot of people somehow recognized that massacre performance and the film spotting hat, which of course is right here on stage, brimming in front of this live audience. Josh is going to reach in and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Ian Kaiser right here in Chicago.
Congratulations, Ian.
Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your film spotting t-shirt.
Do we go right into the sex?
I need some more film.
Is that all right? You don't need a rehearsal?
No, it's okay. I can do it.
Okay. Yeah. Then we'll shoot the rehearsal.
Great.
It is time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater with a few strategic line changes to the script to not make it any more obvious than it definitely is going to be. And of course, as we like to do with these live shows, we're going to pick someone from the crowd to come up and act out this scene with us. And you've got a really important part, but you're not really filling big shoes, I'll tell you that. So, you know, you can be just awful and it will be fine.
You should see how many heads just looked at each other now.
So here's what we want to do, actually. We're going to rig it a little bit. We want you to raise your hand if you want to perform Massacre Theater on stage, and if you have been listening since before episode 100. Can you say that? Tyler's going to pick out someone to come up on stage.
Narrows it down.
It's all on Tyler. Blame him if you're upset.
I do.
Come on up.
Karen from Cincinnati.
You came all the way from Cincinnati for the show. Talk right into the microphone there.
Right into the mic, okay. Even closer.
I'm going to try
Hello?
To find you a script here, Karen, real quick.
Okay, good.
Because I dropped the ball on that one. Sorry. Everybody, but Karen from Cincinnati.
I've been listening since episode number 23.
No kidding.
Yep.
Wow. And it is remarkable that Karen came from Cincinnati. We met up with some people earlier in the evening, and Robert Lewis coming in from Damascus, Maryland. Courtney's here from Boston. We've got Brett Merriman in from L.A. People from Atlanta, all over the country, actually came in for this show. So a lot of pressure on us to make this good. Thank you so much for coming. I think we've got the script. And does Karen have her part?
I do.
We're working on it.
Are you familiar, Karen, with the film?
Yes, I am.
Okay. We figured you would be. And it looks like Josh is going to start it off. I also have a prop for this one.
Okay. Got it?
Good.
All right.
Okay. Hey, where's mine?
So do I have to turn it on or just do it when I'm ready, Josh? Because this is his toy.
A button right there.
Okay. Okay. We're going to give it a shot here with the sound effects. Karen, are you ready?
I am ready.
Josh, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, here you go. And action.
You must choose.
Don't listen to him.
Don't let him kill me. I can't hold him any longer. I can't. I'm weak. Too weak. Help me.
We're almost done.
I'm going to end this once and for all.
You can't kill him. He must stand trial.
He has control of the Senate and the courts. He's too dangerous to be left alive.
I'm too weak. Don't kill me. Please.
It is not the way. He must live.
Please, no.
I need him.
Please, no.
No.
Don't.
I broke it.
What have I done?
Power! Unlimited power!
What have I done?
And scene. Wow.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
That was something. I really hope Ryan isn't listening right now. He's probably just completely abandoned the Skype call.
Karen, you know what you've done. You've committed Massacre Theater. There's no going back.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is August 11th.
By the way, that's actually my nephew's lightsaber, so you've got a problem.
I'm in trouble.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net. Thank you very much, Karen. That was great.
Brennan, it's been a while. Where have you been eating?
Back to school.
Yeah, no, seen you. What's it been, a couple of months?
It's been a while. Give Emily my locker number.
A few days ago, is I wrong?
No.
You know, it's been so long, I don't know your two stats.
It's been a while. Who's she been eating with?
I don't know, that's hard to keep track.
Is it?
Can be. It can be hard to keep track of those things because lunch is a lot of things. Lunch is difficult. She hasn't been doing too good, Brennan.
Yeah, well, I'm not looking for a pad shop. Em's life is her own, but she asked for my help.
Help with what?
I don't know. I don't even care. It's not my business. I just want to know she's okay. So we're going to find her. That's all this is.
Perhaps the defining movie of the film spotting era there, a clip from Brick, Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Brendan and Matt O'Leary's brain in that film from Rian Johnson, his debut from 2006, first reviewed on the show in April of 2006, and we talked to Ryan, interviewed him on the show in August. He later joined us for a great top five film spotting university films, basically the five films we'd give to anybody aspiring to be a filmmaker, required viewing. We chatted again with him for the release of The Brothers Bloom, and he's appeared on the show over the years. And of course, we named the Golden Brick after his debut film. It only seemed fitting to have him be a part of this special 500th episode. And just for the record, we invited Ryan long before the big news came out of his latest directing gig, just a little film you may have heard of, Star Wars Episode 8. And here he is joining us from San Francisco, Mr. Star Wars Episode 8, Rian Johnson. Ryan. Lots of applause. Can you hear it coming through the mic there?
I can hear it. Hello, everybody. I'm so happy to be here electronically.
Well, it's great to have you. Congratulations on the gig. What can you tell us at this point? How is the Episode 8 process going?
There's not a lot to tell. We're just getting into it. But I can tell you that I can tell you that I'm really excited by all the stuff that I can't tell you.
Fair enough.
I think everybody's in for a real treat with what's coming up, and I feel like a little kid right now. I'm just really, 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 really happy. Anyway, so.
Well, Ryan, it's Josh here, and we actually haven't had a chance to talk yet, even though you've got a long history with the show. I do want to assure you that Adam made sure that I was a huge fan of Brick before he even approached me about being on the show, and it was absolutely one of my favorite films of that year. So it was great to see that you've also been a fan of the show. That's just fantastic. I'm curious, as far as the Star Wars job goes, why did you take the job? I mean, people think of it as a no-brainer, but there's got to be a reason where you came to that decision. This is what I want to do, because certainly you're a filmmaker with a lot of options, a lot of ways you could go with your career. What was it about this huge project that you thought, that's what I want to do next?
I'll be honest. When they first talked to me about it, I thought it was going to be a really, I thought I was going to, you know, go home and make a list of pros and cons and kind of, I thought it was going to be an intellectual decision, like figuring out if this makes sense. And the decision ended up not being, you know, it ended up just being that the thought of doing it made me so incredibly joyfully happy. The thought of my life for the next couple of years being working on this and trying to, you know, getting to play in this world and make something I could be proud of in this world that I've loved since I was a kid was that it ended up just entirely coming from the heart, the decision. So, and you know, like I said, already I'm having the time of my life. So it's, yeah, it feels like a cliche to just say, you know, we all, for me, literally the first movie that I can remember my dad putting me in the car to go see was Star Wars. And I know we all have, or a lot of us have stories like that. So it's nothing unique, but there's something really special about now as an adult filmmaker getting the opportunity to play in that world. So.
Now, once you made that decision, is there one thing you think that landed you the job, that got you the job, that they saw in you or that you said, or a personal attachment, anything like that, that you can point to?
I can only assume it was a clerical error. I can assume. Like the beginning of Brazil, when the fly gets caught in the typewriter and it prints the wrong thing, instead of Tuttle, somewhere, Brian Johnson, who is actually qualified to do this movie, mailbox just infuriated, just rightly so.
We are big fans of his work, of course, Brian Johnson. Your first tweet, Ryan.
Yeah.
Your first tweet was hilarious, of course, that clip from The Right Stuff basically saying, you know, I hope I don't F this up. And I am curious how your life, first of all, has changed since the announcement, and what is the biggest pressure you face? Is it external, or is it too early for that kind of pressure, or is it internal? Is it pressure you're putting on yourself?
There was none until you just brought it up now, and now I'm terrified. What are you doing?
Sorry.
Now I'm scared. No, life hasn't really changed at all, except that I'm working on this now. In terms of the pressure, it's weird. Like, I don't know. And I don't know whether I'm just kind of like a tightrope walker, not looking down, but so far I've kind of been waiting for the scary, oh my God, I'm actually doing this, to hit. And it really hasn't. I think the folks at Lucasfilm, you know, they're great creative folks who are all in it for the right reasons. And it kind of feels more like summer camp than it does a high pressure job. It's just a really good creative environment here. So I'm sure the terror will hit at some point, and I'll text you in the middle of the night when it does.
Love it. Well, yeah. I know that you're a director, like many directors, who likes to revisit films or visit films sometimes to inspire you as you're working on a project. And I'm curious, do you plan to spend time with any particular films, you personally, the crew, the cast, as you get further along in this process?
You know, it's funny. We have been just watching movies all together. Just like for a week, we were just getting together every night and watching a different film, some of which were more directly applicable than others, some of which were just getting our heads in. You know, like we watched 12 O'Clock High, which is the great World War II kind of Flying Fortress movie with Gregory Peck. But then we also watched some stuff that was farther afield. We watched, what was the weirdest one we watched? We watched this Russian film called Letter Never Sent, for some weird kind of esoteric reason. So just for different reasons. We're watching just kind of like a bunch of different stuff and talking about it with the whole team. And it's, like I said, it's just part of that terrific creative environment that that we're trying to get going with this thing, I guess, you know.
So your three previous features, Ryan, have all been original concepts, and this time you're obviously working with a pre-existing idea to some extent. So maybe it's similar to your work on shows like Breaking Bad, where you're coming to something that's been in existence and there have been creative hands on it already. Can you talk a little bit about what you liked about that sort of filmmaking process and maybe what's challenging about it?
Well, it's a little bit different because with Breaking Bad, it was, you know, I didn't write it all in that. I was, you know, there were terrific writers. And so that was literally just coming in as a director to do the work. And with this, I'm writing the script as well and directing it. So it's true. It definitely has to fit into a bigger picture. But weirdly, it doesn't seem that, I don't know, even when you start from scratch and write something original, you have kind of the initial idea and you're still fitting into a bigger picture. You still have, I don't know, the process of writing is almost kind of figuring out the box that you're in, but you're definitely still in a box. You're trying to make something very specific work to a specific end with specific restraints on the story. So it actually doesn't feel that unfamiliar. It just feels like working in kind of a different genre and working in a different box to belabor this already tortured analogy.
As far as those pre-existing Star Wars films go, I'm a defender of the prequels. I feel like all of the prequels. I do feel that they, both the good things and the bad things about them, tap into what's true about the original films in a way that's just fantastic to experience and possibly uncomfortable to experience when you're an adult and watching these. Yet that's what I do like about them. So my question for you is, am I crazy?
No, I don't think you are at all. I think there is something really beautiful to the prequels, and they have a real, when you step back, and there was a interesting, one of these mashup videos that was put out recently where someone cut all three of the prequels into like a 6-minute trailer. When you watch that, you watch the shape of the whole thing and the way the whole thing is laid out. There's a beautiful elegance to it. But I will say with these movies, we're trying to harken back to like the feel and the tone of the original Star Wars Christmas special. That's actually our...
Yeah, I'm not even going to go that far. I do want to...
This is a big spoiler, but we do have Jefferson Starship coming back.
I do want to put some pressure on you, though, and relieve some from me. Huge family question. My kids have yet to watch any of the Star Wars films, so we're obviously going to start getting ready and doing that. Do I start 1 through 3 or 4 through 6? I can't do this myself, so I need you to tell me, and that's what I'm going to do, whatever you say.
Wow. Jesus.
See? See?
My personal take is you do 4 through 6, and then you do 1 through 3.
Thank you.
Just because storytelling-wise, 4 through 6 were constructed with the notion that you wouldn't know it was 1 through 3 yet, and 1 through 3 were constructed with the notion that you know 4 through 6. So a little bit
like
backward.
It.
So, Ryan, obviously, your 500 shows, we're taking a little bit of a stroll down memory lane, so maybe you can play along here. And I know this might be very tough for you to follow along with this question, but I don't know, let's say you had a time machine. Maybe there's another version of you in the past. He's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt or something. I don't know. Just imagine. And I'm curious, what would the current Ryan Johnson go back and tell the Ryan who was about to make Brick?
I wouldn't say a word. I wouldn't get out of the time machine because I'd be afraid I would screw everything up. You always screw, in time travel, you always screw something up when you try and interfere. So I wouldn't, I would keep the sports almanac in my pocket and I would just go straight back. It'd be the dullest time travel movie ever, but.
That's fine. We can move on, but we're going to get to your top 5, Ryan, of the film spotting era that I hope you have meticulously crafted. But I am very curious about your embrace of film criticism. You are dating a film critic, great film critic, Karina Longworth, hosts a podcast currently. You've been obviously on this show and other film podcasts. You correspond with many film critics on social media. And I basically want to know, what do you see as the function of film criticism? And maybe what's the best criticism you've received, positive or negative, something that you got that actually really did strike a chord with you?
Well, I don't know. It's weird. I can only just speak to how I read stuff. I don't want to make any like grand statements about film criticism or its purpose or something. But just for me personally, I mean, first of all, it's two different questions. Like, when you ask like how have I ever gotten any criticism that has helped or whatever, I go back and forth, but I don't think filmmakers should read their own reviews. You do, because you can't help it. But at the end of the day, I think with good film criticism, the reviews aren't written for you. And good film criticism, from my perspective, is not a grade on the term paper that's telling the filmmaker what they did right or wrong. It's a writer who has seen a film and had an experience of it and is writing honestly about what they experienced in that theater. And so I love reading film criticism of other films. Again, not in the sense of seeing some checklist of this was good, this was bad, here's your list, not in a Consumer Reports style way, but the film critics that I love reading are all writers that I love reading, and the way their minds work are interesting. So seeing how they take in movies and how they report on what that experience of watching that movie was, that's what I really love. So yeah, and I do really like that. But it does get tricky and emotionally thorny when it's your own stuff. Just inevitably it becomes, you know,
Ryan, I'm really grateful for that answer, because Josh has actually been pushing for a more Consumer Report style podcast.
I think that's good. Like I said, if you have an interesting voice, you can get away with the other thing. You guys, I think letter grades, I would do 1 to 10.
Okay. We'll come up with something. So, okay, Ryan, only a couple minutes, but I did give you a little bit of homework for this interview. Top five films of the film spotting era, 2005 to 2014. What do you have?
Can I call an audible? Can I do 10 really quick?
Absolutely. Yeah? You can do whatever you want, Ryan.
You think you're Adam?
Yeah. But these are movies that everyone knows, so I'm not going to even give explanation problem. I'll just run through them. So kind of starting at the back, but it's kind of fuzzy. This is what I came up with. Holy Motors, Upstream Color, The Tree of Life, Under the Skin, The Darjeeling Limited, Inglourious Basterds, A Serious Man, No Country for Old Men, The Master, and There Will Be Blood.
Great picks.
I do want to give a shout out to Josh about Meek's Cutoff, which is a beautiful and terrifying, creepy, wonderful, excellent movie that I think, if anyone out there hasn't seen Meek's Cutoff, that's something you should definitely hunt down immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ryan Johnson, we've obviously been following your career closely. We look forward to following it for another 500 episodes or so. Best of luck with everything. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, Ryan.
Guys, you guys are the best.
Well, I would say that interview classed things up a little bit, so let's keep things going with some more professionals. Up next, the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. Slate's Dana Stevens. We'll have our favorite movies of the film spotting era. The film spotting top five is next.
And on our way out here, and we are going to play a song here in the break like we usually do on the show. If you want to run out, get some popcorn, get a drink, whatever, stretch your legs, you can go do that. And as you're heading out, we're going to see what our partners over at Film Spotting SVU picked as their favorite film spotting era films.
This is Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU, and I have to keep this short or I will literally not be able to email it to Adam, so I will very briefly say that my favorite film of the film spotting era is, let's go with David Fincher's Zodiac. It's a great film. Congrats to Adam and Sam and Josh and everyone in the film spotting family. I am proud to be a part of it, and congratulations again, and here's to 500 more episodes, guys.
Hey there, Josh and Adam. Allison here from Film Spotting SVU. 500 episodes is insane and amazing, and congratulations, you guys. My favorite film from the film spotting era is probably Roy Anderson's You the Living. I think about it all the time, especially the scene on the train, which is just one of my all-time favorites. Congrats, guys.
If I had wings like Noah's dove, I'd fly the river to the one I love. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well. Well, I had a man, strong and tall. He moved his body like a cannonball. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well. I remember one evening in the pouring rain, in my heart was an aching pain. Fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well.
Hey, Film Spotting fans, music critics Jim DeRogatis and Greg Codd here from Sound Opinions.
There's no doubt that we love music, but what you may not know is that we also love movies, especially movies about music.
So we've partnered with the Music Box Theater in Chicago to present the 4th Annual Summer Music Film Festival. It runs August 15th through 19th.
For 5 nights, catch new and unique music films featuring the likes of John C. Reilly and Yoko Ono, plus some classics like Prince and Purple Rain, now celebrating its 30th anniversary.
To kick off the fest, Greg and I will host the first screening on Friday, August 15th. It's Jonathan Demme's incredible Talking Heads concert film, Stop Making Sense. And in years past, the audience has been literally known to dance in the aisles. Stop making sense! Stop making sense!
Stop making sense! Making sense! Proceeds go to benefit Chicago Public Media. More info at soundopinions.org, and tickets are on sale at musicboxtheater.com.
For my unborn child, well, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well.
Hello, my name is David Wayne. I'm thrilled to be a part of this evening tonight. Sorry, I can't be there in person. You know, thinking about all the movies that came out during the film spotting era is just a lot. And so to narrow it down to one, I don't know if I could do it. But so I did 6. But looking over my list of 6 movies, the thing that I realize is the connector is they all have really memorable endings, so much so that they're probably the most memorable part of each movie for me, the thing that really sticks with me. So I don't know what that means. You can think about it. So I guess there's spoiler alerts here, so cover your ears if you don't want to be reminded of or if you've never seen these movies. But in chronological order, from 2005, Munich, with the scene in the Twin Towers, incredible. 2006, Lives of Others, that last line, this one's for me, or whatever it was. Oh, my God. I mean, come on. Michael Clayton, 2007, the tape recorder, the escalator. 2008, Anvil, the story of the big concert. And then A Serious Man in 2009 with the tornado. And then this year, Boyhood. Whew. Up on the Mountaintop. So, you know, these are brief 2 or 3 words I gave about each movie. But listen, what do you want? I mean, I'm not a film theorist. That's what those guys do. And they speak eloquently about this stuff week after week, and it's required listening, and I'm just thrilled they do it. Happy New Year for when it comes up. And good night.
Live from the Music Box Theater in Chicago, this is Film Spotting, our special 500th episode with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. David Wayne there, of course, director of the new film, very funny new film, They Came Together, with Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler. Also, Role Models, Wet Hot American Summer, and others. He's obviously a very funny guy, a great guy, and a friend of the show, and we thank him for sharing those fantastic picks, his 6 favorite films of the film spotting era. This week, we are celebrating our 500th episode with the top 5 films of the past 9 years or so, 2005 to 2014. Earlier in the show, Josh and I shared our 5 and 4 picks for the grand finale. We welcome to the stage, you see them here, 2 great friends of the show, frequent guests, Michael Phillips and Dana Stevens. Thank you, guys. Thank you for coming.
Welcome back.
Now, congratulations. Mazel tov on your 500th show.
Dana, all the way from New York City. Michael, all the way from around the block.
Yeah, it's Logan Square. All the way from Logan Square. Can I just say one thing? Dana and I are also working on a Star Wars reboot, so can we do 10 instead of just 5? Like
no.
Ryan did? Like no. Ryan got to?
Well, you know,
a guy who didn't even come? Just because he's working on some reboot of, what was it, Stargate or A Star is Born? Or
I'd like to see that. I would like to see that. So real quick, we'll get your picks. We're going to recap our 5 and 4, Josh. Your 5 and 4 were?
So 5 was Meek's Cutoff. 4 was Volver.
My number 5 was Inglourious Basterds. My number 4 was There Will Be Blood, both co-signed by Rian Johnson. I'm sure you heard there. Michael, your 5 and 4.
My 5 and 4. My number 5 is Ratatouille, because I love the little streak that that Pixar was on with the three films of theirs that mean the most to me, which Ratatouille, Up, and Wall-E, not in that chronological order, but those are the three that to me are the ones that was the peak of a certain kind of popular entertainment in any medium in this country during those years. I think that's the fact that they found big audiences, not necessarily epoch-changing, you know, sort of Avatar-sized audiences, but just enough of an audience to convince the bean counters, yes, we need to overspend on the next one, too, and take the time. And Brad Bird, really, with Ratatouille, just took a premise that didn't, you can't believe he made it over the hump with anybody, this idea of the rat who wanted to become the gourmet chef. I love it. And that's a film... That's a film, unlike a lot of Pixar films I love and maybe a little less so like, that film, I think, the shape of that film just gets better and better and more involving and then very touching at the end. I love it.
Michael, your check from me for that pick, it'll be coming about Thursday or Friday.
Okay.
Nice work.
So what about your number 4?
My number 4 is a film that actually, it's a documentary that a lot of people have not seen called Last Train Home. Who has seen that here? Anybody? Montreal-based filmmaker, and it's Li Shunfan's documentary about this incredible migration going on in modern China, where you have a family from a rural village in Sichuan province, and the families are completely split up, with the kids staying with the grandmother in one part of this massive country, and the parents working in factories in another part of the country. And it's just simply a reminder that the global economy isn't really what most people are being told it is. And it's an emblem of why documentaries became so necessary for so many of us as moviegoers in the last few years. The breadth, the stylistic breadth of documentaries right now has never been better. And sometimes you just need to go to the movies to hear and see the truth that may exist right around your corner and may exist on the other side of the world. I love the film, and see it, please, because most people have not seen Last Train Home.
Including us, unfortunately. You always have to give us at least one pick, Michael, that we've usually never even heard of.
I'd heard of it.
So
that's great. I've heard of Film Spotting, too. It's a great...
Fair enough. As we transition to Dana and her picks here, we want to remind you that you can, of course, tweet at us, use the hashtag FilmSpotting500. Tell us what your favorite film of the film spotting era is. If we actually somehow stay ahead of schedule, we'll try to get to a few of those as we get throughout the show. Dana, your 5 and 4 picks.
Okay, so my number 5, which I'm sure is going to appear on a lot of lists tonight, is Tree of Life, Terrence Malick's film from 2011. So why does this appear? Great movie. So why does this appear at number 5 on my list of 5? That seems like a little bit of a diss to Terrence Malick. I think it's essentially because, for one thing, I knew that one of you two guys would pick it for one of your top 3, and we'd get lots of love and attention from you. But secondly, I think it's the only one on my list of 5 that doesn't seem to me, it's not as perfectly realized. It's still a very rough movie, and everything, the whole frame story about Sean Penn and Houston going up in an elevator and experiencing spiritual malaise, none of that really works. For me, I think there's also long parts of some of the flashback stuff that doesn't work. And yet, what this film sets out to achieve, the ambition, the philosophical ambition, the cinematic ambition, and what it does manage to achieve in that central section with the small boy growing up in Waco is, I think, as great as anything any film has achieved in the last not only 9 years, but a couple of decades.
Where does the creation sequence fall in that scheme for you? Is that successful?
I'm pretty much behind the creation sequence. Okay. I'm not going to say I can understand everything in it. I'm not going to say that it's necessarily shot by shot exactly what I would have envisioned. You know, it's quite long, and I don't know what the dinosaurs are up to, but I love his crazy grandeur and taking all of that on, and just the beauty, the incredible Proustian kind of beauty of those memory sequences. So that's my number 5.
We'll see if we can salvage that diss for Terrence Malick, only having him at number 5. I mean, yeah. He might unsubscribe from the podcast, and that'd be tough.
I saw him in the lobby, by the way.
Yeah. I'm sure. Sure. Dana, you're number four.
And my number four is Children of Men, Alfonso Cuarón. Which is, of course, Alfonso Cuarón's 2006 adaptation of the P.D. James novel. And I guess I choose this one because it's one of those rare, rare movies that works at every level. It's a tense action thriller. It's a political parable. It's sort of a religious parable. It is a great human story about characters and relationships, and it's got humor in it. And I don't know. I mean, there's no other film I can think of. And then formally, of course, it has all kinds of filmmaking bravado on the half of both Cuarón and of Emmanuel Lubezki, his cinematographer, who really, I think, work together as a true team in this and all their collaborations together. So Children of Men, sort of for its formal perfection. Mm-hmm. And its thrills. I didn't want to double any filmmakers, so I didn't name two Paul Thomas Andersons or two Wes Andersons, but I couldn't help but name two Emmanuel Lubezki DP films because he's got his fingerprints on everything that's interesting in cinema right now.
We will accept that. We'll definitely accept that. We're off to a great start then with this top five. Michael, let's go back to you. Your number three film of the film-spotting era.
Taking a chance because it was my favorite film last year, and you know, you're very nervous about coming that quickly and looking. You cannot fake more hindsight than you have or more perspective than you have. And when I look back at the number one, and I'm reluctantly forced to rank my top ten in the Tribune every year with a gun to my head, I rank them. And often the number one, it tends to be a film I really still love, but they tend to be smaller and maybe more the achievable, excellent film. I look back at, you know, like a decade ago, or Capote, which I love, but it's smaller. And this is the case also of last year's favorite for me, which I still made my top five here, Spike Jonze's Her. And I think love a lot of his work means an awful lot to me. I think, but there's something very challenging about imagining the very near future, very near. And I think when another decade or two goes by, I think we're going to find that the film and its sort of weirdly delicate mixture of comic and dramatic strains was right on the money in terms of the seductive allure of the next life-changing gadget and the pitfalls therein. And, you know, that's not a new theme, that's an old theme. But I think that one I found really rattled around in my brain a long time. And a lot of people don't like it as much as other Jones films because the protagonist is sort of stuck. And those are tough movies when you have a protagonist that is emotionally numb, stuck in some way. And they're hard. That's very hard to activate as cinema, but I think Jones is enough of a true visionary and a kind of a lovely fantasist on screen. That's my number three.
Wonderful choice.
Well, thank
Dana?
You so much. Thank you.
I approve.
Thank you.
My number three is Christian Mungiu's Romanian film from 2000. What year is it from? 2007. 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. And is that on anyone else's list? I don't know. I guess we'll wait and see. So to me, one of the most exciting developments in cinema over the film spotting era since these guys have been working, and really almost precisely coinciding with that era, is the Romanian New Wave, as it's called, which is this sort of loose term for essentially a lot of very smart, very low-budget movies coming out of Romania, which tend to have certain things in common. They're very aesthetically minimalist. They have a very dark sense of humor. And they usually take place in the past, in the recent past, during the Ceausescu era, and are sort of investigating the repercussions of the dictatorship in Romania. So 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, to me, is the crowning jewel of this Romanian New Wave period. And I won't get into the whole story, but it is the story of a young woman under the Ceausescu dictatorship trying to get an abortion, and her friend, principally the story actually of her best friend, who's shepherding her through this nightmarish journey of finding the illegal abortionist and making the appointment and finding a place to do it. And it all sounds very grim and nightmarish, and it is, but it also is just such a thrilling work of art. The way that it's filmed, the cinematography, which is this handheld camera that flows with every movement without ever drawing attention to itself, is just one of those movies that's beautifully crafted without being about technique and being about mastery. It really is about this story and these characters, and it's just a gem.
Yeah, I'm really glad you had that to represent that movement, because you're right, it does parallel these years we're talking about, and of the ones I've seen, I've not seen them all, but that's the standout for me, 4 months, definitely. My number three, though, is Where the Wild Things Are, another Spike Jonze film. I have this theory, and this is I'm not including you in this theory, Michael. I'll say that right from the front. But her is a little bit, I feel like possibly it received such effusive critical praise from some because it hits a personal sweet spot. Okay, for, let's say, contemporary critics who might be 30-something, they can see themselves in this socially awkward, somewhat nerdy guy. Well,
20-something in my case.
20, yeah. See, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, you're far too young to be like this guy. But it's one of these pictures where it can hit you right where you are, and that's not a bad thing. And I saw that happening with her. It just didn't, for whatever reason, happen with me. It did happen with me, though, from Jones, with Where the Wild Things Are. That was the personal connection film that he made that just really grabbed me. It hit my personal sweet spot. This was the best adaptation I could hope for of the Maurice Sendak picture book that actually, it just blew my mind when I was a kid. When I first saw it, 1963, that's not when I read it, but reading it a few years later, it opened the door to me to this idea that fantasy is really, in essence, this ever so slight creative warping of reality. It didn't have to be Star Wars. It could be, and that was awesome, but it could also be this idea of your bedroom turning into a forest. And Jones, he brought me back to all of that through his creativity and the filmmaking team. I mean, the production design here and the costumes and the effects are just amazing. He brought me back to that through the cinema as an adult, which for me was just remarkable. And Where the Wild Things Are also brought me back just to boyhood itself, more than even Richard Linklater's boyhood. And that's not a slam against Linklater's film, because I think it's interested in very different things than boyhood along with that. But for me, this was the movie that brought that back. So for doing it in a magical way, Where the Wild Things Are does have a special place in my heart.
One of my top 10 films of the year it came out. It's a great choice. My number three, a little bit more obvious, unfortunately, and you have heard it referenced already. It is the Coen Brothers' No Country for Old Men. Michael also applauds this pick, don't you, Michael?
I like that film fine, Adam.
Fine is not good enough, okay? You have to love it. I will confess, I strongly considered Inside Llewyn Davis for this list, actually even ahead of No Country for Old Men. That's how much I love that film. A very different movie, but one that is nevertheless, I think, wrestling with a lot of the same big questions and the big themes that the Coen brothers always wrestle with. Free will, modern man's position, their struggle in a chaotic, unruly, and unruled universe. And the scenes that stand out, as I talked about my memories of the last 9 or so years, the ones that were just there and can never be replaced. I think about many scenes from No Country for Old Men, the hotel shootout, the cat and mouse game that happens before the hotel shootout with the money at that motel, the crime scene conversation, hilarious, darkly comic conversation between Garrett Dillahunt and Tommy Lee Jones, the call it at the gas station, of course, with Javier Bardem. And then finally, the Bardem and Woody Harrelson confrontation is just great cinema, even though it's just those two guys sitting there in a room. And as we talk about that poll question, the death match with Linklater and Soderbergh, one of the things you brought up, Josh, is Soderbergh being a little too cold and clinical for you, and that's fine. That's a fairly common criticism of him and his work. But the Coen brothers, of course, have gotten that as well. And while I understand it, just like I understand it with Soderbergh, I don't really fully get it. And Jim Emerson wrote some great things on the Roger Ebert site, his Scanners blog, about No Country for Old Men, and I wanted to read it here. He said, "No Country for Old Men has been called a, quote, perfect film by those who love it and those who were left cold by it. Joel and Ethan Coen have been praised and condemned for their expert, quote, craftsmanship and their, quote, technical skills, as if those skills had nothing to do with filmmaking style or artistry, as if they existed apart from the movie itself." And Emerson then proceeds to break down and illustrate how all of that craft, all that artistry, and the technical proficiency serves the work as a whole. And for me, that really is the essence of great cinema. I hate the word perfect in criticism. I hate the word imperfect when it's thrown around in criticism, as well as it applies to any art. I think it turns art into math, but I will begrudge nobody in saying No Country for Old Men is a perfect film. It's my number three. Michael, you're number two.
My number two is a film, again, like Last Train Home, I'm afraid, is not well-known by many, but it's the first film I ever saw by a Turkish filmmaker named Nuri Bilge Ceylan, and it's called Climates. It came out in 2006, and it was the first film I saw of his, and it's a picture about what happens after the end of an affair between these two people, played by the director and his wife, Abreu Jalon, and people invoked everybody from Antonioni to all kinds of directors to describe it. I don't think any of them apply. I really don't. It's the most bruising relationship film I've ever seen, I think. It was the first film I ever saw shot digitally that made me think digital could actually look, in the right hands, as good or more interesting than some film. And I think when you fall in love with a filmmaker, the first film you see of theirs is always going to be in here somewhere. That even if they make films that are grander, more ambitious, maybe even better for you personally later, there's something about the first one. And I don't know, it doesn't happen every year, folks, where you just see a film by any filmmaker where you just fall in and you fall into kind of a state of suspense where you're just thinking to yourself, please don't blow it. You know, just stay together. You know, I want this film to stay together. And I felt that way with Jones's Where the Wild Things Are, which is an incredibly emotionally bruising experience. I mean, that's a hard film to see a second time. I love Wild Things, but it almost puts you through so much of a ringer in such a bold way, you know, off the book, and but true to the spirit of sin. And, but that was another one where I was just holding my breath and said, please, don't blow it. Don't compromise. Don't take a shortcut for the audience's benefit. Don't, and Climates was like that, too.
I was so sure it was going to make your list, Michael, that today
you
I
saw
was
it?
Determined.
Oh, you saw it, Adam.
I was determined to finally
don't
catch
get
up with it.
Oh.
And then I decided to take a nap. It's a late show. I'm an old man. No, but I was searching frantically for my copy of it. I was going to watch it, and not only could I not find it, but then I did decide, that we've been planning for a long time to do a Jalon marathon, because Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, we all three adored.
Which is a marathon in itself. Even
it is,
I love
yeah,
it.
3 hours yeah. long, but that's the only Jalon film we know. So I think I'm going to save it. We'll have you on, and we'll dive into Climates certainly at some point down the road here on Film Spotting.
Well,
so,
great. We three can just have a ball listening to it.
Yeah, and it will be us three, probably. Dana, you're number two.
I have to say I love Michael's picks. There's two so far that I've never seen. So your list has really
got
me.
That's what he does
me.
To us.
Well, I mean, technically, I haven't seen him either.
There's always a catch.
I wanted to tone it up a little.
Class up the joint a little bit around here. All right, my number three is Werner Herzog's Grizzly Man from 2005. And so this was kind of a toss-up for this spot on the list. I knew I wanted to put a Werner Herzog documentary, but it could have gone Grizzly Man, it could have gone Cave of Forgotten Dreams, which is also one of my favorite movies, for sure, of the last 9 years, and maybe of all time.
Greatest 3D, probably, in
certainly,
modern...
Certainly,
yes,
the only, maybe the only movie in 3D I've ever seen that absolutely had to be in 3D, and that really brought something new in 3D. And I certainly think that anyone who's a citizen of the world should see Cave of Forgotten Dreams, but I put Grizzly Man on here just because I don't think in the history of documentary there's been a marriage of material, you know, subject matter, and filmmaker that's as right as Grizzly Man and Werner Herzog somehow meeting up with each other. This true life story that he discovered about Timothy Treadwell, this man who, I guess you would call him a bear activist, a bear enthusiast. I mean, he's not a scientist. He's not any sort of...
It's kind of a bear stalker.
He's the kind warrior, as he calls himself. Yeah.
I mean, the true story of Timothy Treadwell is already so amazing that any documentary about it would be interesting for the subject matter alone. But the eye that Herzog brings to it, and the way that his interests, all of his obsessive interests throughout his career, including, you know, the conflict of man versus nature and obsessive monomania, you know, people that kind of pursue their obsessions to the point of self-annihilation and destruction, you know, all of these Werner Herzog... also exploring parts of the globe and parts of kind of culture that had never been explored before in film is a big Herzog thing. And so all of that comes together in Grizzly Man in this incredible way where you feel like, how did the story manage to be told so rightly by this man? So Grizzly Man is my number three.
I love this. Your picks are filling in the holes that I wasn't able to but wanted to. Romanian cinema, documentary, I don't have one of those, so this is great. And then I can be boring and repetitive and go with No Country for Old Men for my number two. There's a huge cosmic question that's hovering over the genre perfection, I'll say genre perfection, Adam, that is the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men, and it's this. Is this universe indifferent and arbitrary, or is there something, someone out there who gives a damn? And Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh, he's, you know, the angel of indifference, right? Just random death. So he's one answer. And then we have Tommy Lee Jones' sheriff. He's someone who cares. Watching it again recently, all those scenes are the ones I think of too, Adam, but the one that really stuck out is when Jones pulls the deputy over, whoever it is who's carting the bodies away of the murder victims, pulls them over and just covers them with the tarp. You know, who in this, all the things he's seen, why does he bother to do that? I mean, what does that mean? Well, it means something to him. So every time I watch No Country for Old Men, I wonder if the movie's going to answer this question for me, or is it just laying it out there for us to kind of sigh over? And this time I thought maybe the answer lies in a very small line. And it comes from Kelly MacDonald, who's the—I think she's the wife or the girlfriend. I don't quite remember.
The wife, yeah.
Wife,
yeah.
Of Josh Brolin's character. And this is when she's cornered by Bardem, and he pulls out that coin to determine if she lives or dies. Indifference, arbitrary, right? And she just says, the coin don't have no say. And it was just this little act of defiance in the face of extreme indifference that just jumped out at me this time. So second best film of film spotting era is No Country for Old Men.
Well, I'm going to continue the boring, obvious choices here, but my number two, it is Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. And back in April 2013, we did our top five Malick scenes. I went through film by film, listed all my potential options, and I had 10 just from The Tree of Life, which was at least double more than any of Malick's other films. And I love many of his other films. Two of them ended up making that list, The Dinner Table Fight with Brad Pitt, in one of his best performances, if not his best performance, and one I called Innocence, which just picking that and trying to describe it really reflects the challenge of picking specific moments and scenes and sections from a movie like The Tree of Life and many Malick movies, because the scenes all just melt into each other. They form this maze of memory and just the sheer audacity. I mean, Dana, you said it so well, the audacity of The Tree of Life. The origin of the universe, that sequence, which I love, and we did talk a little bit about the dinosaurs and what they could mean on the show, but how can The Tree of Life not be our 2001 for the people who weren't able to see that movie in the theater? That's the feeling, hearing stories from people who saw that Kubrick film in 69. That's how I felt watching The Tree of Life. And I think the crux of all Malick's films really culminates there in this film, this line from, I think it's Brad Pitt in voiceover says, of course it's voiceover, it's a Malick film. He says, there are two ways through life, the way of nature. Actually, it's not Brad Pitt for sure, but the line is, there are two ways through life, the way of nature and the way of grace. And that, for me, really is at the core of Malick's work, and the notion that it's a rigged game. You do have to choose one of those options, which one you're going to follow. You can't stay in paradise forever. And I think that lament, but also, to use your word, Josh, his character's defiance in the face of that brutal reality is what really is so moving about his work. And I want to read, actually, something we got back. You'll appreciate this, Michael, especially being a fan of the Pixar work. Back in 2011, after reviewing this film on the show, we got an email from Andrew Stanton from Pixar. And when I saw the email pop up, I thought, well, there's probably many people named Andrew Stanton in the world. Surely it's not him. And then a day or so later, I finally got to reading it. And no, it really was Andrew Stanton, who, of course, we did have on the show later. And he said this: it wasn't until I walked back out into the sunlight from viewing this film that I realized how much I had given up hope on ever being changed again by cinema, how I had begun to doubt it ever had that ability, that perhaps only because I was simply young, hungry, and impressionable, movies had been able to alter me. Tree of Life brought me back from the brink of cinematic cynicism. Transcendental has too few syllables for the film. I'm so grateful to have been alive at the time of this film's release and am fired up to accept Malick's challenge of doing more with the movie than we think we can. I think that says it all.
That's great. It's also a reminder and a testament, I think, to what you spoke about, Daniel, just, which is embrace the chaos of a movie that is blatantly imperfect. I mean, all you need is your favorite hour 20 minutes out of The Tree of Life, and it is something to reckon with. And that's, of course, the Sean Penn stuff is on the floor somewhere, you know. And it's that this is Malick is a guy who finds the ultimate shape of his films, months of editing, and everybody who, all the A-list actors who end up doing a few days or a week or longer on a Malick film, they know that it's likely they won't be in it. And I saw Michael Shannon somewhere at some festival, the local actor Michael Shannon, very fine film actor, and he said, yeah, I just shot a couple of days on something. He said, I'm not going to be in it. And he knew. And Sean Penn did not know that he was, that Sean Penn did not know he would just be a murmuring voiceover artist, you know, at the end of that cut. But what's central to it is pure magic, I think. And it's everything he's good at. You know, it's all the things that make him sort of a cliche. If you don't like him, the murmuring voiceover, the wheat, you know, all that. But that hour, that the stuff that is truly about a family, and it's not realism. It's his own brand of magic, and it's all you need is an hour.
Is there some magic in your number one pick, Michael?
Man, it's all magic, baby. It's There Will Be Blood. There Will Be Blood for me. And again, not a perfect film. It's a film I'm still, frankly, kind of wonderfully vexed by that last half hour in 1927, the epilogue, where Daniel Day-Lewis, has just turned into this pathetic drunk who must kill his adversary, Paul Dano, and then call for his butler, whoever it is, "I'm finished!" And that tonal change at the end is still unlike anything I've ever gone through. It's like, what just happened? And yet, most of that, I don't even know what I think of that ending yet, but I think the first, you know, most of that film is essential to the American experience and a certain kind of American corruption that's very complicated as anything in the last quarter century. And I mean, everything, there's so much that's, you know, and a lot of it came back in The Master too. Anderson is wonderfully old school in many ways as a cinematic artist, but he's also, again, in a wonderful way, he's intuiting his way through the kind of story he wants to tell. And it can be very perplexing narratively. It can be a lot of things, but my God, it's a great film. My God, it's a great film. You hear me?
Let's hear it. Come on. We're with you, Michael. Dana, you're number one.
All right, well, I'm feeling like Michael is a bastard in a basket because he took my number one. And in fact, I have to confess that over dinner we discovered that we both had There Will Be Blood for our number one, and he tried to get me to change my order.
I couldn't do it.
I'm comfortable with saying that There Will Be Blood is the best movie of the last 9 years, and I think you just said it very, very well. I was going to follow up on something about the last segment, which, when we cut to the present day, I feel exactly the same. I still don't know quite what to make of it. It's obviously an insanely powerful ending. I'm not quite sure what it has to do with what came before, but there's also that little juncture in between that I think does bother me. It's the one part of the film I don't quite love. It's when the son comes back from the deaf son and has the encounter, the bastard in a basket encounter with Daniel Day-Lewis, and something about how completely their relationship has changed and how we know nothing about why. Right, and also even just the shift of that actor. Suddenly there's an adult actor playing the part, and I wasn't quite ready to associate him with the boy who came before. That's always a jolt, right, when a new actor comes in playing the same character. And it all happened so fast that I didn't quite know what to do at the end of that movie.
Well, many people who love the film don't even really know what is Paul Dano playing. You know, he's playing a dual role, and that's not even particularly clear at the first time you see it.
Wait a minute. You mean Paul Dano plays the grown-up version of the
No,
son?
No. But, no, the...
early on.
Early
twins,
on. Early
yeah.
on. Yeah.
Yeah, that is unclear.
It was originally
it
was different casting, and they... Yeah, it's just a little fuzzy narratively, and this is the thing. I think a lot of great filmmakers really, you know, they have that moment of like, is this fuzzy narrative? Am I going to confuse some people? And is it worth it?
Right. I mean, but to me, once again, I mean, talking about, you know, movies that accomplish so much that they don't need to accomplish everything, right, that they can have rough spots. I think There Will Be Blood is definitely one of those, and the rough spots are very few. It's an incredibly masterful and accomplished movie. I mean, I guess the only thing I have to add to what you said is that I feel like I just remember the moment of sitting down and first hearing those Johnny Greenwood chords at the beginning of the score and seeing those first shots of whatever that landscape, Western landscape, is at the beginning, and just feeling like I was in somewhere entirely new. I've never been in this cinematic space before, and that's such an exciting feeling.
Right.
And yet, I mean, obviously Paul Thomas Anderson is a cinephile who loves American cinema, who's binding up all these other tropes in there. There's Citizen Kane, and there's John Ford Westerns, and there's so much in that movie, but yet it feels entirely, radically new. So that's why it's my number one.
Yeah, I thought of Citizen Kane too, but it's almost, to go back to another filmmaker, Citizen Kane as made by Terrence Malick, maybe. It's like some merging of the two, and it is something else. It is in my top 10, but I'm not going to make it 3 for 3 for my number one film.
No, this is the boring There Will Be Blood side of the table. You guys have to take it somewhere else.
Well, not entirely new territory, though, however. I sat down to watch The Tree of Life again earlier this week. It was Wednesday night, and it was early evening, so sun's still up, sun going down, actually, and the room where we've got the TVs, a fair amount of windows, and it's west-facing. So as the movie starts, it was a beautiful night Wednesday. Those of you who live here know that. Windows were open, breeze coming through. So the sun, shafts of sun across the TV screen, and I can hear that breeze, and it's intermingling with what are already whispers and voiceovers that are kind of hard to get a hold of. And usually I wouldn't stand for that. That would drive me nuts, right? Pull the blinds, shut the windows, let's focus, let's get this thing, just in front of us with nothing else. But it was really something because it felt so natural to have that happening to this film. It felt almost appropriate that nature would become part of this movie. I don't think any other Malick movie, even though he loves the wheat, has captured nature quite like this. And not only that, I mean, it's not only that it's at one with nature, but that then he uses it to be an evocation of the reality that we see and feel and experience every day. So I think the triumph of The Tree of Life is that it manages to do this, make these connections on both this intimate scale with this family that I think pretty much everyone agrees is like, that's where it all is. But for me, it does translate to the other parts of the film too, so that it works on this epic scale as well. We've got this family of three boys, we've got this awesome creation sequence, and so, you know, for the reasons that you guys have talked about, I think it's not just a picture with cosmic aspirations. I mean, Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain, that has cosmic aspirations, and I like that film, but they're still aspirations. The Tree of Life somehow fulfills them, and in doing that, it sort of achieves this cosmic resonance. So for me, it was my no-brainer number one.
Well, before we get to my number one, we do want to share a few quick listener tweets. Adolfo Acosta, Pan's Labyrinth is my favorite movie of the film spotting era. Josh Oakley, he gave us 5 in ascending order. Margaret, The Social Network, Children of Men, Synecdoche, New York, and Boyhood. Alex Charner, all the way in from New Jersey, longtime listener of the show, The Diving Bell and The Butterfly.
Oh, excellent.
Sam, a former live show Massacre Theater participant, my favorite film of the film spotting era, In Bruges. Also heard from The Film Review, this is film with a PH. Best of the era, The Act of Killing, the definitive movie about human nature's dark and light. Great choice. And David Sergazin, favorite film, Take Shelter, just keeps rising in my esteem. That Jeff Nichols film, I really did have to give a lot of strong consideration to, but just missed the cut. Josh, you want to share a couple more here real quick?
Yeah, let's see. We have from Ben Pfeiffer, my pick for best film, The Social Network. Sharon Feldman said, Let the Right One In and also The Lives of Others. Dave Pfeffris, number one film, Asghar Farhadi's A Separation. Good pick. Yeah. Penelope Pitstop, David Gordon Green's Snow Angels. Interesting.
Wow. That's a good film, yeah.
Yeah. And Mark Herney helps out with the show all sorts of ways. He says, an honorable film spotting cheat with Michael Haneke's... Oh, thanks, Mark. Is it Cash? It's Cash.
It's Cachet.
It's Cachet.
Cachet.
Okay.
Hidden.
Nice
it's
job
Oregon.
Putting me on
it's
the
Oregon,
spot
Josh.
There. The White Ribbon also and Amour. I did consider those as well.
Well, leave it to Josh to ruin this. Not only did he not have There Will Be Blood, the only one who didn't have it in his top five, but this could have been a clean Paul Thomas Anderson sweep at number one, and you just had to put a big roadblock up there, Josh. My number one is The Master.
Ooh, wow.
And
really?
I said it to you, Josh, as we were walking out of recording our last episode. I've said it to Sam as we were preparing for this list, that if Paul Thomas Anderson was just a little bit more prolific, this would have been the easiest top five ever. I just would have said everything he's made since 2005, there's my top five, call it a day. But unfortunately, he hasn't given us that much. And I love Andrew Stanton's line that I read in my Tree of Life pick, where he said, I'm so grateful to have been alive at the time of this film's release. That's how I feel about all of my picks, but especially this number one. And as I talked about There Will Be Blood and the intimacy of Paul Thomas Anderson's film, this is at its core. It is a tale of two men ultimately struggling to express their love for each other and accept their love for each other. And we see that throughout Anderson's work, of course. This father-son relationship in Blood is a key part of that. But we also see in his work this deconstruction of the myth of the self-made man. His films are loaded with people who are struggling to be self-made men and somehow assert their identities, or of course they're filled with people who have done it, like Daniel Plainview, who finally do achieve success, but at a great cost, with tremendous sacrifices to their humanity. I find that fascinating in his work. And as I was thinking about this pick, I actually thought about something I remember hearing from the great critic Matt Zoller-Seitz. He was on an episode of the Cinephiliacs podcast, and he chose Born on the 4th of July as the movie he wanted to talk about from Oliver Stone, this being this pivotal, just a seminal film for him. And coincidentally, as I was thinking about this, another movie about a veteran, all of my picks, But There Will Be Blood, have some kind of war connection to them. Even No Country for Old Men, there's a little bit of a connection there with the Josh Brolin character. But Born on the 4th of July, a film Matt Zoller-Seitz has long championed, and his grounds, that, as he explained it on the Cinephiliacs, has always stuck with me. He said, the most basic, most personally important story that movies can tell is that search for truth, that search for personal, transformative truth of who you are, of what your world is, what your country is. And that discovery of identity, discovering our true selves, is not only, I think, what Paul Thomas Anderson explores so brilliantly in all of his films, but it's also, I think, what compels us all ultimately to the cinema. It's what brings us to places like the Music Box to watch and transform ourselves and transform ourselves through the transformations we see the characters undergo on screen. And that, for me, is really why this crystallized The Master as my number one choice. We do have a few other picks to share, including from, we often mention, the Film Spotting Advisory Board. This is a group of listeners over at the Film Spotting Forum who help us out in all sorts of ways. And it's about 8 or 9 different people, and they somehow agreed on a top four when they submitted their picks. They loved, number one, The Tree of Life, 2, Certified Copy, great film, of course, from Kiarostami. Number 3, The New World, another Terrence Malick pick. And their number 4 was Flight of the Red Balloon from Ho Chau Shin.
Oh, fantastic.
Unfortunately, there was a 7-way tie for number 5. So we don't have any kind of resolution there, but that is somehow, Josh, we're done. That's our top 5.
Wow.
That's our top 5. How great were Michael Phillips and Dana Stevens?
Thank you, guys.
Of course, we've been getting your tweets, but we really do want to hear any feedback you have on the show. You can email us at all. You can email us, as always, feedback@filmspotting.net. Sorry, distracted for a second by Sam Van Halgren, always in my ear. He wants me to remind everyone that we are going to pose the top 5 films of the Film Spotting era poll over at filmspotting.net. We're giving you the choices, basically culled from our list. You can consider, Josh, the options.
The Master. All right, we got The Master, No Country for Old Men, The Tree of Life, There Will Be Blood, and, of course, Other.
It will be interesting to see if those 4 somehow encompass the bulk of the choices, but if you want to go Other, you can do that. We hope you will go now and vote at filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting, that's Adam, and at Larson on Film, that's me. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/filmspotting.
We really do have so many people to thank who made this night possible. We want to start out, Josh mentioned Mark Kearney helped us out on our Facebook page and selling some t-shirts here tonight, some restaurants here locally, the Mystic Celt and Delise, and Matt Miles and the crew from Fresh Roasted Films you've seen around here. They're locally based, and we do want to thank them for coming out and helping out with that recording of the show.
I also want to thank Dave Jennings and Doug McLaren here at the Music Box, WBEZ for sponsoring this whole event, WBEZ sound engineer Mary Gaffney. Mary, I hope I was speaking correctly into the mic here. Sorry if I wasn't. Video technical director Kyle Hammond from KBH Media, and our event manager Tyler Green.
And I want to give them a round of applause, especially there, Mary, Kyle, Tyler. This does not happen without the work of Tyler and Kyle, making everything happen video-wise, audio-wise, right on cue. Ryan Johnson coming up perfectly. Let's hear it for him, everybody. I also want to thank Film Spotting's associate producer. She is a Texan living in Australia, visiting Chicago. She's here. Her name's Candace Griffiths, and it's amazing because Candace is someone, when did we first talk online? 2006, maybe? About 2006, she was just a Film Spotting Forum member who was always up late because, of course, she was in Australia and the time zones were different. And as I was finishing editing the show and nervous about how it sounded or if we missed something and didn't put a clip in the right place, I wanted some ears to listen to it. And she was always up about midnight on Thursday nights, and she started listening to it and would give me tips and give me little comments about the show and be kind of our QA person on the show. And ever since then, she's been an integral part of the show. So I want to thank Candace, especially down here in front. Thank you, Candace. Other people who Film Spotting doesn't go with, if we don't have them, it is Golden Joe Dassault. Thank you, Joe, our fine producer from WBEZ. Also, of course, want to thank our other producer, the esteemed Sam Van Halgren, and every Film Spotting co-host, Sam, Maddie Ballgame Robinson, and Josh Larson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's always a blast. And before we get out of here, thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Debbie, our wives. You guys are cinephile enablers of the First Order. We couldn't do any of this without you guys. So
indeed.
For Film Spotting.
You know, not yet, Josh. Oh. I have one more. I just found out here as the show was beginning, end of the first segment, none other than my mom walks up from Iowa, surprised me, didn't know she was here. So thank you, Mom. And especially in light of what Rian Johnson had to say, and we were talking about Star Wars and the movies that impacted you, he said that was the first film that he went to as a young man that really did hit him with the power of cinema. I wouldn't be sitting up here with these great critics if I wasn't about 5 years old and my mom takes me in our old gray station wagon to the drive-in to see Star Wars with my best friend Justin, and the whole way home we played Millennium Falcon. I was crushed when we sold that thing because it was our Millennium Falcon, but you know, we were Han Solo and Luke Skywalker, and that really was the beginning of all of this here on Film Spotting. So thank you, Mom. Thank you to everyone here who came out tonight. We couldn't do it without you.
For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening. Good night, everybody.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.